Good afternoon, Dr. Tim Cooley. I'm excited to have you on my podcast. I would like to introduce you, first of all, for the viewers who are watching this. Dr. Cooley is former member of American United States Air Force Academy. And right now, he's a president and founder of Dynamics Consulting. He also owns Dynamics Consulting, and he has a variety of experience, including holding numerous positions, including DMSO Modeling and Simulation Chair, Deputy Department Head, and Senior Researcher. And his previous military assignments included Squadron Commander of the 1987 Communication Squadron of Lowry AFB and Land Mobile Radio Manager for Sinconard. Is that right?
Think NORAD.
SingNORAD. Okay, sorry about that. SingNORAD. It's something to do with the NORAD, right?
Yeah, I was Landmobile radio manager for the commander in chief.
For NORAD.
Yeah, of NORAD.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for your service, sir. Thank you for being with me today. If you don't mind, let's jump into the questions. I would like to audience to know if you can explain how has military training changed because of new technologies like modeling and simulation, if you can explain to the viewers.
So modeling simulation isn't all that new. Obviously, we've got more capability today with higher visualizations for projectors, better projectors, and more computing power and so forth. But modeling simulation gives a lot of game-changing opportunities to military training. For example, if you want to train in the rain, you can simulate that in a trainer, whereas you don't have to go out in the rain. And obviously, there's some places where it doesn't rain that much. If you want to train at night, you can simulate that in a trainer with modeling and simulation, which does, and then you don't have to be outside in the night. Again, there are times when nighttime isn't the best time in places. So we can do lots of different things. We can simulate wind. We can simulate sandstorms. We can simulate all sorts of things in our modeling and simulation trainers, our simulation-based training. So it's been a game changer in that aspect, in that we don't have to wait for the right conditions to occur to go out and do the training that we need.
So you mentioned you can simulate rain and snow and weather control. Is there a weather control? Can you simulate earthquakes?
I mean, you could for sure. I mean, I'm thinking more of like our driver trainers where we simulate ice on roads, and we could certainly simulate earthquakes and those kinds of things. And our marksmanship trainers in the same way. Earthquakes, I don't know, is as big of a deal. I suppose shaking targets would be the simulation of that. But when you're talking about wind on marksmanship trainers and so forth, drift of ammunition, those kinds of things, we can simulate them in a modeling or simulation-based trainer,
Thank
versus
you.
having to worry about going outside and calculating, oh, we need a day when there's at least 20 knot wind or something. It's hard to
Wow.
pick those.
Wow, that's very interesting. And how do you figure out if a training system is actually valuable and what makes your approach different?
So I've done a lot of work in this. I've done a lot, published a lot of papers on return on investment for modeling and simulation, and we won the Defense Acquisition University Research Paper of the Year in 2011 for that exact topic. So there's lots of different ways to determine if they're valuable. Not all of them are monetary. And matter of fact, in the U.S. Department of Defense, you don't get a lot of monetary benefits because there's no revenue stream coming in from modeling simulation, but you get increased readiness, you get increased lethality, increased training capability, So there's lots of those things. And so you have to figure out how to measure those. And that's what we've done a lot of work on. How do we measure these non-quantitative, they're qualitative measures that we put in. So that's one way. The other way is I work for the Marine Corps, do a lot of calculations on what we call cost avoidance. So how many dollars are you avoiding by not driving actual vehicles, by not expending actual munitions, some of which are very expensive, some of the five, and then what are you not save or not spending by having airplanes, simulated airplanes run instead of the real ones. So it turns out to be quite extensive. You know, it's nine digits typically.
Technology is amazing, and technology is growing every day. Every day we are seeing new things coming up, everything, same time, everywhere. Everything everywhere at the same time. AI hits us so hard. And my next question to you, sir, is what are the biggest challenges you face in ethical issues you face when you model things like criminal or terrorist networks? What kind of ethical challenges or biggest challenges that you face when it comes to terrorists or criminal organizations?
The biggest challenge in any model is to get the right data. And of course, when you're talking about that specific niche, it's hard to get the right data, right? Because it's not like criminal networks are out there going, oh yeah, this is what we do and this is how we do it. Same thing with terrorist networks. There's a difference, actually a very big difference between criminal networks and terrorist networks. Terrorist networks are all about taking responsibility or taking wanting the publicity for doing something. So, hey, we did this, we're this terrorist network, we did this. Criminal networks are, we don't want any publicity. We want to be underground. We don't want to be found out. We're all about making money. The terrorist networks make money or need money. And that's where those two interface mostly is in the fact of criminal networks will give terrorist networks money to do certain things for them. So, but again, it's all about getting the right data and modeling it correctly.
Thank you, sir. I was also wondering, I have another question related to this because I came up with an idea as a former member of the Tamil Tigers who was forcibly recruited and eventually defected and surrendered to the Sri Lankan military, who helped them significantly to obliterate Tamil Tigers militarily in 2009. Within 14 years, I worked with the Sri Lankan Directorate of Military Intelligence. I have a question that how do we identify genuine terrorist members when they infiltrate or exfiltrate Western countries, like especially in Europe and North America, with the refugee influx, and they try to infiltrate disguised as civilians or refugees. For an example, I came up with a model called photo force multiplier theory, also in intelligence known as link analysis, which is that you have one identified genuine terrorist who can identify others, and then we can use that one identified by that terrorist or member or the terrorist member of a terrorist organization, and then spotter force multiplier emerges, and we can always arrest many members. Is that a viable modus operandi or tradecraft in intelligence techniques, or do you have any other model to identify and arrest and terrorists who are infiltrating Western countries disguised as civilians? What do you think about that?
I mean, what you said, I think is viable. I'm not at liberty to speak much on anything else, but yeah, I mean, obviously, if you have a known terrorist that can identify others, that's a way to do it.
Okay, thank you. And the other question is, how does your work on medical tools connect with your military experience, sir?
So I never connected the two, much at least, but. When I was working on the medical research I did, which was like 20 years ago now, we had others that were working with the same techniques on target recognition. So I was identifying tumors or small lesions or whatever in mammograms, they were using very similar technology to identify, a tank in a battlefield or an armored personnel carrier or something like that. On, obviously not the same images, but still images, let's put it that way. They're not X-rays, but they're infrared images and so whatever. So that's where the connection comes in. A lot of that connection happened in the 90s when President Clinton did his big commercialization of military technology, and they're looking for different ways to use military technology, and all the things that we had. And so that was one of the things that came out of that was, hey, we can use some of the target recognition stuff we have for recognizing tumors. So
The last question is, based on your expertise, what are the main problems with using artificial intelligence on the battlefield? When I say battlefield, I'm talking about not Ukrainian-Russian battlefield or Gaza-Israel battlefield. I'm talking about the future warfare will be shaped by whoever take control of the global commands. That means the air domain, space, cyberspace, and the maritime domains, and the global commands that large by large. And they also say the future warfare will be shaped by air-sea battles. If you can explain to me, so the concept of global commands and security intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance theories a little bit.
So I'm going to do maybe a two-part answer to that. The first one is my view, and I think it's shared by others, is that the battlefield in the air, remember, I'm an Air Force person, is not going to look like what it would today. I don't think we're going to see these big dogfights anymore, the fighter jets going against fighter jets. We'll see a guy up there with a very, very capable, or gal, very, very capable airframe. Maybe the latest, the F-47 or whatever we're building in the United States. And probably each one of those, it's kind of up in the air how much a person can control. But let's just say it's five or six drones, essentially, with that one person. He becomes more of a air battle manager than a fighting pilot, although he'll have the capability to do aircraft on aircraft. But I envision that being the case because it's cheaper to build a drone. There's no man in the loop, so you have to worry about getting someone killed or captured. And I think that's where we're headed, which brings to the challenges of AI, because those drones are going to be controlled by mostly AI. The one thing that the US military right now has not done, and I don't believe they will for a long, long time, and that is they can't do AI that will automatically take out a target. That has to be human controlled, which is what it should be. So I think that's one of the main problems, is there's going to be some speed because you're still going to have that human in the loop. The second main problem is whenever you're doing AI, if they're looking at inputs, which AI, the name of the game for the future battlefield is going to be data. Data is king. And so it's getting the correct data. And so I've envisioned a lot of tactics and techniques of infiltrating bad data into adversaries' sensors so that when they start doing the AI on it, it's a bad situation. It doesn't do it correctly. That's where I envision the big battle being.
Thank you, sir. One last question before we wrap up this. I was wondering, intelligence is capital in any warfare. How can the information warfare or the intelligence warfare shape the future battles? We see today, 3 years or 4 years, Russia is fighting, and Israelis are fighting the Hamas for 2 years. It's never ending. So I think that the most effective way of dismantling the enemy is that inter dominance in the intelligence dominance. So in that sense, how can strategic and tactical intelligence can be played a major role in battlefield? And what do you think about, according to your expertise, what is your opinion about the information warfare or the intelligence warfare shaping future wars?
I mean, it always has and it always will. You're only as good as your intelligence, right? You're only as long as you know what targets are there, what the enemy's doing, the more you know about what the enemy's doing, the better you can respond. And that's always been the case and it always will be the case. So people think, well, we've changed a lot of tactics and we have, but diversion is still key. And you can look at that. The latest sorties we flew over to Iran to bomb the nuclear facilities with the B-2s. We flew a bunch of B-2s west. So it was confusing people. So it was a diversion tactic.
It's a
And
deception.
deception, right? So we still do that. And so that's to mess up adversaries' intel, right? And I don't envision that tactic and technique going away anytime soon.
Thank you for touching upon the strategy deception. Thank you for your insights. Thank you for talking to me. Good to talk to your insights, and I hope the viewers will understand what is the future battles against terrorist networks and criminal networks, and how the future warfare will be shaped by AI. Thank you for your insights, sir. Thank you.
And thank you.